Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. John Bolton's book isn't out, but it feels like it's out. It's all over the place. The Department of Justice is asking for an emergency order to suppress the book, which I think it's safe to say is not going to happen. So we are going to be talking about that. Our guest today is Bulwark contributor Kim Whaley, a constitutional scholar who is out with a new book. There's a theme to your books, Kim. So your last book was How to Read the Constitution and Why. And this one is What You Need to Know About Voting and Why.
So. Yeah, there is a little connection there, right? You can see what my broader aim is here, which is expanding basic civic literacy outside the law school classroom and to make it somewhat entertaining and easy for people to access. And I think both books do that, for at least for some people.
Yeah, well, the book about voting, we were talking about right before we started this, I think is going to be, it's going to have a long tail to it, that there's going to be a lot more focus on it when we get to October, November, and realize that we thought we knew everything about voting, but things have gotten a lot more complicated and the stakes just feel much higher than they've ever been before.
Yeah,
this could be an election unlike anything we've ever experienced, and we've experienced some pretty horrific FUBARs in the past.
You know, I think on the ballot is this might sound like hyperbole to some, but I think on the ballot is American democracy versus something approaching more like authoritarianism, because, you know, the guardrails of democracy, the job description requirements haven't been enforced. So really, it is November that where Americans will decide if they're okay with some kind of, you know, government that is not responsive to the people's needs and can bully and can ignore the rule of law. And if you're on that team, if you're on Team Trump, you're okay with it. But the problem is you can't go back to the other way if that slot is filled by someone you don't like. So you know, the framers of the Constitution didn't expect the experiment to last more than a couple decades. And the last really vibrant democracy was in Athenian Greece 2,000 years ago. So the notion that we're just democracy in the United States is set in stone, it belies history and logic as much as I think people assume. It's kind of our birthright. It's not. And I just think that that's what's on the ballot, in addition to these people that want jobs or want to keep their jobs, from the president all down to your local officials.
Well, you packed a lot into that. And by the way, I agree with you there. And this actually relates to something that I do want to talk to you about, which is all about John Bolton, about impeachment. And, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but one of the interesting questions, of course, is that if John Bolton had actually come out with all of this information earlier, had the House not rushed through its impeachment process, if four Republican senators had voted to actually hear witnesses, would it have made any difference? And I don't think it would, but this goes back to your theme, that we keep looking to the courts or to Congress or to other norms to protect us. And basically right now, the last line of defense is the ballot box. And that if we expect anybody else to step up and fix this, we're wrong. I mean, we voters, we're on the front lines now.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of, and you know, this piece I did with the Bulwark this week, there's a lot of objections to voting on the theory that it doesn't really matter, or people are cynical, or they don't like the candidates, or they think the system is rigged. But at the end of the day, I mean, that defeatist attitude is just buying in, really, to people, you know, cynical foreign leaders, including Vladimir Putin, who want to see Americans divided and stay home from the polls. I mean, it's the only thing left. And I agree with you that if Bolton had testified, and as you know, I was critical of the Democrats for not pushing for these witnesses when they had the baton in the House, you know, go to the courts. I think that was not a good strategy. But even if he had testified, the evidence was pretty overwhelming, both on obstruction of justice. I mean, that was a lay down. They're essentially were saying that it's okay to obstruct Congress. But on abuse of power, the excuses just didn't hold water. And so you add him and these incendiary, troubling, and we'll talk about it, things that we're going to see in his book. I just don't believe the Republicans in Congress in that moment in the Senate would have crossed the finish line, the Rubicon, and actually done what's best for the American people in terms of the rule of law. And then we'd be in a situation where all of that was in our rearview mirror when we're leading up to the election. So you could make the argument that now is a better time for Bolton to come out of this, because at the end of the day, the only checks on the presidency, the only tickets for speeding that are left are November.
Yeah, so on this issue of obstruction, so he talks about, even though Ukraine was the case that got Trump impeached, he argues that this was a pattern and practice. He said that Trump committed plenty of other impeachable offenses, tried repeatedly to halt criminal investigations into autocrats in China and Turkey. And this is what he writes directly. The pattern looked like obstruction of justice as a way of life. And he says that he reported the cases to Attorney General Bill Barr. I don't know, because he believed that Bill Barr was going to be this defender of the rule of law, whatever. And then he turns, and I think this is going to get a lot of people to roll their eyes. He's critical of House Democrats for missing all of this. He writes, had Democratic impeachment advocates not been so obsessed with their Ukraine blitzkrieg in 2019, had they taken the time to inquire more systematically about Trump's behavior across his entire foreign policy, the impeachment outcome might have been different. Well, of course, you can hear 1,000 voices saying, you could have helped a little bit more, couldn't you?
And they also, they had a trial with no witnesses, not one witness. That certainly doesn't show any, sort of serious interest in getting to the bottom of the facts. And as I said, I agree with Bolton that the Democrats could have done more, but that nothing was going to change in the trial phase. I mean, trial is in the Constitution in the Sixth and Seventh Amendments, and it refers to evidence. I mean, so when you talk about originalism or textualism or whatever you want to talk about, there's not an argument that trial doesn't include some form of documents or witness testimony, period. But the Mitch McConnell got away with basically distorting that whole process. So I don't know. Maybe I'm just too cynical about the political forces in the Congress in this moment.
Come to the right place to express the cynicism. But you and I were both somewhat critical of the speed with which the Democrats were moving through impeachment. It did seem like, hey, wait, just guys, maybe more stuff will come forward. But I also think ultimately you're right, that even if they had taken their time, it wouldn't have made any difference. Because again, we've seen how Republicans react, and they're all in. Look, if there's a breaking point for Republicans, and I feel silly even saying this, the stuff that's coming out right now would be the breaking point. But we know that there is no breaking point. So John Bolton, is getting ripped by pretty much everybody here. And I do think it's important, that you don't, and I wrote this in my newsletter, that you don't have to like the guy, because he's not that likable. You don't have to think he's a patriotic hero. You don't have to embrace his foreign policy to realize that the one thing that he's got a reputation for is telling the truth. And he just dropped this huge truth bomb. And I don't know whether or not this is completely unprecedented. That's kind of a worn out word. But leaving aside Watergate, Kim, has there ever been a moment where so many high-ranking officials of a presidential administration, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff, have come forward and said, this man is unfit. This man, we've watched how he thinks, how his mind works, how he makes decisions. And folks, it's scary. I can't think of any moment in American history where we've had that kind of testimony against a sitting president. And if voters aren't paying attention to this, I don't know what they need to hear.
Well, I mean, I worked on the Whitewater investigation under Ken Starr, where, Bill Clinton was impeached for lying about an affair with an intern, and that's not okay. I'm not condoning that at all. But that was considered scandalous and serious. And then we had, emails in the lead up with Hillary Clinton using a server and multiple investigations of that. What's chilling, a couple things that appears to come out of Bolton's book. One is his statement that every decision he could not think, he said, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, of a single decision that the president made that was not about getting reelected. If you just think about the consent of the government governed, you think about government by we the people, you think about different policy platforms, or Democrats and Republicans can have different objectives. I don't think anyone's objective is to do what's best for Donald Trump and to stay in power. And that's how he's governing. And this isn't shocking. I mean, we don't need John Bolton to tell us this. We just all kind of have this normative bias to kind of try to find some thread of normality with this man, decency. And the other piece you mentioned, obstruction. I mean, let's talk about that for a second. You know, this is about using the arm of the Justice Department to basically get goodies from foreign nations. China is adversarial to us, but we're seeing this play out in real time as well, with what Bill Barr has been doing in terms of Mike Flynn, filing this lawsuit against John Bolton, the civil lawsuit, which is of a piece with Trump's thousands of bullying cease and desist letters that he wrote through his private lawyers when he was a private citizen about any critics. We've seen the Justice Department itself morph into an arm, a bullying arm of this president. I mean, we have to have a government that cares about what people, the regular people, want. And that if they don't, there's a consequence. It's meta here. It's not just Donald Trump.
So, but just briefly, this Department of Justice effort to ask the courts to issue an emergency order to prevent the publication of this book because they say that it contains classified information. What are, on a scale of 1 to 100, what are the chances that a federal judge would issue an order of prior restraint against a book that's actually already in the warehouses?
I mean, as a First Amendment, from a First Amendment standpoint, what happened with in 1970 with Nixon? No, courts aren't going to do that. But if you read the complaint, what's stunning, and I tweeted about this, it doesn't even ask for that. If you read the complaint, there's a paragraph, I think it's paragraph 46, where the Justice Department states that their first level of review found no classified information in the book. So they're conceding the defense to the lawsuit in the actual lawsuit. I mean, that never happens, Charlie, right? And then if you look to what they're asking the judge to do, they're essentially asking the judge to order Bolton to nicely ask the publisher to not publish it. And they say that's assuming Bolton has the authority to control the publisher, which of course he does not. So the whole thing from a legal standpoint is smoke and mirrors. It's essentially the way I see it, and I teach civil procedure. You know, I teach litigation rules in federal court. I've been doing it for years as a full-time law professor. This really is almost like a big kind of using the federal courts to kind of make a tough guy stand. As a legal matter, it's extraordinarily thin. It's not saying that he violated national security laws and needs to be held, accountable for that. It doesn't say that.
So it's basically just sort of, once again, performative Trumpism, maybe a lawsuit filed with an audience of one, the one not being the federal judge.
Right. I mean, the judge is like, if I were the judge, I'd say, what are you asking me to do? You're asking me to tell Bolton to say something to their publisher? Like, what? I don't even know what that is. And their theory is, Charlie, one is breach of contract, where they go back to the NDAs. But the NDAs people sign when they have access to classified information inside the government, those are enforced in the criminal justice system. I mean, if you violate that, you can be criminally prosecuted. So they claim there's a breach of contract. And then they make this like generic fiduciary duty obligation, which is not grounded in any statute. I mean, it is a common law concept. They're basically saying, you know, Bolton owes it to the American public as a fiduciary to not publish this. Again, you know, this is legal wonky stuff, but this is really thin. I mean, this is throwing spaghetti on the wall and hoping maybe something sticks for a couple seconds before, you know, it falls to the floor and the dog eats it. I mean, I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many things that are in this book, and which apparently is very badly written, at least according to the reviews.
You're talking about his book, not my book, right, Charlie?
No, right. No, we're definitely talking about John Bolton's book. I have to say that, you know, and again, we struggle against being numbed by all of this, but the passage of the book where he describes how Trump is meeting with the Chinese President Xi, and Xi explains to Trump that they're creating these concentration camps for the Uyghurs, and Trump said that Xi should go ahead with building the camps, which Trump thought was exactly the right thing to do. Now, I mean, concentration camps, for Christ's sakes. I mean, really, what I wrote this morning is, I mean, look, we've seen this before, you know, Trump's fascination with, you know, the performative cruelty of strongmen. But I mean, even by the kids in cages Trump standard, that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, and think about, there are thousands of these people. They're in, you know, re-indoctrination camps. And why are they there? They're because of their religion. They're Muslim, primarily Muslim, but there's also Christians that have been rounded up. I mean, the fact that the president thinks that's okay to round up with no due process, no trial, no charges, just by virtue of their religion. And the reports are that it's pretty brutal in these camps. You know, atrocities are happening in these camps. That to identify a group of people based on their religion that and ping them as somehow too rebellious for society and have the police throw them in concentration camps indefinitely to get them to think like the rest of the country. I mean, I don't know how that is a picture perfect view of sheer dictatorship and tyranny. Again, I just don't think this is even about politics anymore. It's not about team red over team blue. I mean, this is about team democracy, team freedom over team tyranny. This is what the framers were worried about and the revolutionaries fought and died for.
Yeah, but it is team red versus team blue. And you'll see this from the anti-Trump folks that will find some way to change the subject, and if this moves the needle at all, it'll be, you know, one or two points. Trump asking Xi to get reelected, Bolton saying that Vladimir Putin plays the president like a fiddle. See, this raises another question, because I think we're getting this picture of the number of people who are sitting there in the Oval Office and they're watching this president and they understand how horrible it is, how dangerous it is. And I think this goes back to the question that we've been talking about, it feels like, for the last 4 years, which is, if it's this bad, why do you stay? And I think that there was a long period of, and maybe justified rationalization, that we stay because it's important that you have rational grown-ups in the room. But at this point, I think that the imperative is that people, frankly, eventually do what, say, Jim Mattis has done and what John Bolton has done, is like, tell the American people what's going on. Because right, your real obligation is not to sit and continue to enable this or try to pretend somehow that you're going to prevent really bad stuff. You need right now to sound, you know, the red alert.
I agree. Where are the other whistleblowers? I mean, there's right. got to be hundreds of them at this point that know, you know, serious, scary details. And I know people want to blink facts, but facts are facts. You can shrug and say, I don't care. That's fine. But the traditional levers of oversight aren't working anymore. I mean, including just congressional oversight, because once the Senate greenlighted just blowing off subpoenas and requests for documents, we don't have that as Americans anymore. We don't have meaningful congressional oversight. So it's going to have to come through leaks. But people deserve to know who they're voting for and what they're voting for. Although, as I said earlier, I think a lot of this is already out. I mean, what I don't understand, I know you mentioned this in your newsletter, is why the fear of somehow progressivism amongst his base taking over government is somehow more scary than batons and tear gas and rubber bullets when people are peacefully protesting racism in America. I don't know what that boogeyman looks like, and I'm not defending, you know, far left progressivism. I just don't understand that calculus.
Well, it is Antifa. It's like it's either Donald Trump or Antifa. So, George Soros, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What this again is also not new, but it's the process of the reinvention of John Bolton on the right, because what we really do know is that, in this red blue world, if you break with Trump, you're going to be excommunicated. So, Molly Hemingway, who has become basically a surrogate of the Trump administration, tweets out, this is the new line: hiring Bolton was Trump's biggest error after not firing Comey on day one. Anyone else trusting Bolton's judgment or his rather absurd stories is really failing more of an intelligence test than anything else at this late date. And Tim Alberta from Politico subtweeted that, pointing out, keep in mind, this man, John Bolton, headlined every right-wing gathering, appeared on every Fox News show, wrote op-eds in conservative publications, raised millions for GOP candidates, was exalted as a voice of integrity, authority, honesty, and now he is the enemy because he spoke ill of the dear leader. And once again, we're seeing that pattern, and everybody falls in line. Everybody basically does the pivot that Molly Hemingway and the other anti-Trumpers fall into. But still, it is, I find it amazing.
Right. It's a stunning, shameful lack of courage. And I think it just says something about the human brain. I mean, this is not the first time in history that somebody's risen up and people follow them in astonishing, shocking ways. History looks back, and how could people go along with that? You know, I don't know. I mean, that's a question for social psychologists, but I agree. It's the only thing they have left at this point is to just completely blink reality and deny that sure. Bolton is who he is.
Well, let me disagree with you slightly. I don't think it's a lack of courage here. I think it's a fundamental lack of integrity and of any sort of intellectual honesty.
Yeah, no, I think I would put all of those together. Absolutely. What the umbrella in my mind is a value system. There's no lighthouse guiding these kinds of decisions on a personal level, and that speaks to, I think, a bigger breakdown in American culture, American society. This notion that integrity is optional. I mean, yes, I tell my kids that you make every decision with integrity. You might be unpopular. People might be really mad at you. People you care about. You might get in trouble in your job. I mean, but you can go to sleep at night. You'll have your way. You know, it's like Hansel and Gretel. You'll have the stones glowing at night, in the dark path. You know.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about the Supreme Court, because a lot's been going on here this week, including the. Rather, I don't know whether you were surprised by, but I guess a lot of people were surprised by the 6-3 ruling on the whole issue of whether Title VII applies to gays. And then I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, because even as you and I are speaking on the podcast, which of course we tape and people will be listening to in a couple hours, the Supreme Court just ruled against Trump's attempt to end DACA.
It looks like Roberts joined it with the four liberals.
Okay, 5-4. So
I can talk about that. I actually teach, I teach a class called administrative law. It's a super kind of wonky, again, area of the law, and very difficult and complex. But at the end of the day,
yeah, conservatives are going to be very, very disappointed when you think of the rationale for so much of what they have gone along with has been, you know, but Gorsuch or but the courts. That they are experiencing still a number of very high-profile defeats. Just a reminder that Supreme Court justices are not always predictable. And so, once again, this feels like a pretty big defeat for the Trump administration on a core issue.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it also, back to our other point, I mean, judges base their decisions on facts and law. I mean, they're trained that. I mean, it's indoctrinated and ingrained. There are gray areas. There are gray areas where politics and ideology or sort of the approach to jurisprudence can tip the balance one way or the other. And I think in both of these cases, we saw that with the dissents. But what Roberts did in both of these cases and Gorsuch did in the definition of sex case is basically hold their nose on their ideology and apply the plain established law. And that it's, you know, it's hard to get around facts sometimes. I mean, you know, Trump doesn't control the Supreme Court. So this is one bastion of democracy that still is functioning on some level in the United States. And that's why the framers gave them life tenure, frankly, because they can't be voted out of office. They're not beholden to the dear leader like members of Congress.
So just yesterday, I think I saw, I don't have it in front of me, I saw a rather surprising poll number that suggested that even Trump voters favored protections for the Dreamers, that this is one of those issues where it doesn't fall on strict partisan lines. So DACA was an administrative order, correct me if I use the wrong word, an executive right. order by the Obama administration to extend these protections to, and again, the Dreamers are children who were brought here by their parents. They themselves didn't break the law, even though they are quote unquote undocumented. And the Trump administration trying to reverse the executive order. Why wouldn't they be able to do that? If DACA was just an executive order, why can't the next president just issue another executive order?
Yeah, it was actually something called an agency guidance or a non-legislative rule. So it's a little, but you know, I did a piece on this early on and said, when people are attacking Obama and saying, you know, Trump did the right thing, I took that position at face value that if Trump has the authority, Obama has the authority. And essentially what the fight here is about, so Congress passes laws and then agencies get a bunch of power to fill in the blanks of the laws. Usually that's called a regulation. They have to go through notice and comment. It's really difficult, but there's ways that they can fill in the blanks in less formal ways. One is an executive order, but agencies do it by issuing basically interpretations of the law. And that's basically, that's what Obama did. He said, I'm going to not enforce this law because, of course, Article 2, the president gets the sort of law enforcement power. So his position was, I'm telling the world, I'm just not going to enforce immigration laws against DACA. And so the argument is, you know, that's the president's prerogative, just like the attorney general can pick and choose which cases the Justice Department brings. Trump came in and reversed that. The problem is when agencies do stuff outside of Congress, I mean, they have the authority, they have to give good reason. So Roberts refers to this kind of term called arbitrary and capricious, meaning under the statute that governs what agencies do when they fill in the blanks of Congress, they have to give their reasons. We saw this with, this is exactly the reason why the Trump administration failed to add a citizenship question to the census. It's not that the justices were saying you can't do it. It's just saying you can't just do it and not explain with good facts and rationale why you're doing it. And it looks like, and I haven't read the decision yet, but Roberts is just essentially saying you didn't give reasons why it's okay to do this in a way that caused a lot of hardship to DACA recipients. I mean, that's a big hole in your analysis. You have to go back and give justifications for trampling on their interests. You know, you can't just do it by fiat and not give us a reason. And the reason that the law requires agencies to through the president to give excuses is because really this should be done by Congress. I mean, that's a big debate on the Supreme Court, and should agencies be able to basically pass laws, or should Congress do all of it? The court's already said Congress doesn't have to do it all. They can basically use agencies as, you know, paralegals to write laws. But if agencies do it, you got to give really good reasons, or the court's going to make you go back and basically shore it up. So they could go back and recreate a DACA administrative decision that just has a better rationale. The rub here is it's kind of hard to come up with a better rationale. So that might by default might end up killing the decision by Trump to kill DACA.
This is fascinating. So just now, as we're watching all of this, Josh Hawley, the conservative Republican senator from Missouri, who is sort of carving out his own sort of, you know, post-Trump vision of the world, just tweeted out, "The most disappointing week at SCOTUS in years." So you can tell the way this is playing among Republicans and among conservative, disappointing week. So I don't want to get necessarily into the weeds of textualism.
Right.
But I mean, so even among conservatives, obviously there are different views of textualists. Correct me if I'm wrong on all of this, because I've tried to have people explain to me. All of the conservatives on the Supreme Court say they are textualists. Not necessarily originalist, but textualist, which means they read the actual text of the law and apply it. But what we saw earlier this week is that Roberts and Gorsuch have a completely different view of textualism than Alito and Clarence Thomas. Am I right so far? So you have a real split on that, because it really came down to the question of whether or not Title VII, passed in 1964, which banned discrimination on the basis of sex, whether or not the word sex could be read, the text could be read to mean also sexual preference, sexual identity, or whether it just means gender. So you have this really, it was a fascinating debate, and it is a fascinating debate dividing conservative judicial scholars.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem, it's, I don't even think, I mean, the distinction was between sex and gender, because you could say you have a man who's gay, who's fired because he's gay. If that person had been a female, they would not be fired because the relationship would have been in a heterosexual relationship. So the argument is he was fired, but for his gender. I mean, the gender is what made, I mean, the gender translated into a relationship, you know, with a man, that was why the gender was the problem in that context. But essentially what Gorsuch is saying is you can't get around the fact that it is gender, sex, one way or the other, if you're firing people on the basis of what their, you know, orientation is in their private lives, or even in their public lives, if you're talking about a transgender person. And I agree. I was, when I teach this kind of originalist, textualist thing, I do tend to lump it all together because at the end of the day, I think the argument generally is you start with the language of the Constitution or the text and you give it its plain meaning. And if it's unclear what that means, if it's ambiguous, then originalists would say you look to what Congress was thinking in the 1960s, or you look at what the framers were thinking in 1787. And more progressives will say, no, you look to what it means today. So I was really surprised with Justice Kavanaugh's dissent when he said, listen, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for gays and transgender and people and all of that. The problem is that, you know, what did he say? Something like he can't give it a literal reading. You have to give it a reading of the word sex that takes into account the context of the Congress at the time. And that's kind of stretching things. I mean, that's interpreting outside the scope of the plain language, right? It's saying, they're essentially saying back in the 60s, nobody cared. Nobody was writing that statute for gay people. And Gorsuch is saying, that's not my job. I just have to read the plain language. That's what it came down to.
Yeah, but there's a different, we can't litigate all of this. In fact, we sort of have a division among psychs on this. I'm glad that you can't discriminate against people based on their sexual preference. I think that is a good policy outcome. I wish it had been a policy outcome written into law by Congress as opposed to judges, because this does feel like you do have, judicial legislation here.
It is a place where Congress should have stepped up, and I think that was the dissenting justice's position, which is, you know, this has failed many times. We shouldn't be the one to make that amendment. I think the majority is saying it didn't need amendment because the language is really clear, and even if it has a policy implication, we have to read the plain language. I mean, so, you know, I think you originalist textualism, you know, sometimes the box that you're put in by taking that approach isn't a policy box you like. And the argument for it is it keeps judges in their lane. So I don't know. I'm kind of with Gorsuch in this one from the standpoint, not so much as the policy, but the standpoint of what's the role of judges.
Now, again, what is the role of judges? Is it, I mean, essentially what you had was the judges kind of amended the statutory language a little bit. They kind of stretched. But again, you know, so let's be a little bit more meta, because this going back to the but Gorsuch, when you think about in terms of our politics, how we've got to this moment where Trump has gotten the almost blanket support of evangelicals, the Republican Party has, not pushed back. You know, it's hard to overstate to people outside of the right wing how important the judges have become. It is as if we are willing to give up everything. Yes. Everything.
They sold their soul about this.
This is the bargain. We are willing to give up this because these judges are so important. Justice Gorsuch is so important. So there was this kind of, you know, a little bit of a shock this week. Not a little bit. There was quite a bit of a backward reels the mind type thing. So we've made all these compromises, all these sacrifices, and suddenly we don't get what we want. Because for a lot of the right, what they no longer want judges who are going to sit and go, okay, call balls and strikes. What does the law say? What is the constitutional meaning of this particular statute? They want a result. And you had a couple of folks, including, you know, Sean Davis from the Federalist, saying, yeah, forget it. We should stop treating the Supreme Court as if it is a court of law. We should treat it like a legislature and just appoint people who will vote the right way, which is an abandonment of the entire concept of the independent judiciary. And frankly, a breathtaking abandonment of everything that conservatives had claimed that they thought about constitutionalism and the role of the judiciary. So this was kind of a clarifying moment, I thought. Yeah. And of course, but Gorsuch, a good reminder that, you know, Supreme Court justices are important, but you don't necessarily sell your soul because you don't necessarily get the result you expected.
Yeah, and look what Mitch McConnell did to the appointment process for Supreme Court justices by refusing to give Merrick Garland even a hearing, right? I mean, Merrick Garland is, I've appeared before him when I was at DOJ. He's not a sort of off the charts progressive. He's pretty moderate, and he probably would have gotten on these cases exactly the same lineup. If Scalia were still alive, he would have voted like Kavanaugh. So for all of that drama and that sort of, you know, really assault on the process of and the dignity of appointing justices to the Supreme Court, which has long-lasting damage to the legitimacy of the institution, were where we would have been if Obama had been allowed to have his appointment during his office.
Yeah, that scar is going to be there for a really, really long time. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the reaction to DACA is right now. So give me a sense. You know, we've been talking about the law and everything, but back to your book on voting, that we still are faced with this sort of nightmare scenario, and I think a lot of Democrats are really haunted by this, that even if Joe Biden has a 10, 11, 12, 13 point lead in the polls, people are still nervous because, of course, of the Electoral College. And that is extremely unpredictable because it is still possible to draw to an inside straight and win 270 electoral votes by losing the popular vote by, I don't know, what do you think? I mean, you could lose the popular vote by 7 million and still be elected president.
Yeah, I mean, the delta there, the more likely Trump could win without the popular vote. So if and I think Nancy Pelosi understood this a long time ago, if the Democratic candidate is going to win, it has to be, you know, by good margins, not only to get over the sort of problem with the Electoral College and the popular vote, but also so that we don't have a fight in this country or debate in this country over the legitimacy of the election itself, one way or the other. And of course, with COVID, and we are now only 5 states that are still requiring excuses to vote by mail. Most of the other states that did require excuses that didn't include COVID have expanded those excuses to include COVID. But there are still fights over how to certify your mail-in ballot, whether you have to have it notarized. There are lawsuits on various issues relating to the fall election procedures in 27 states right now, when I last checked, because of course the electoral process is rolled out state by state, not nationally. So this means people that have jobs that don't let them sort of wait in line for 8 hours on election day are probably going to have a harder time voting in certain states than people that have the luxury financial means of being able to move their schedules around. And I do think some people in the race, know this, they understand this, that COVID works in favor to some degree, favoring Trump, because if there isn't a turnout of the more progressive wing by virtue of all the barriers to entry, the pragmatic barriers to entry, he can win by default, by lack of turnout, not so much because the popular will really supports him as a mandate for 4 more years.
So let me ask you this, though. There's been a lot of discussion about voting by mail, which I think is absolutely essential, and, you know, huge spread of all that, even in Wisconsin, where nobody ever agrees on anything. The Election Commission voted unanimously to send absentee ballot applications. I want to be very careful how I put this, applications to all registered voters, which is really quite extraordinary given Wisconsin's political history. But are we going to experience something like California around the country? And by that, I mean where the vote count just goes on and on and on with the spread of mail-in balloting. Is it possible we won't know the outcome of the presidential election for a week, 10 days?
Yeah. You know, I do. I think that's one of the things that
not enough bourbon in the world to get us through that.
Yeah. And I think that and that's something really the media needs to be careful about too, and not calling things early, because calling things early itself can be a form of keeping people home from the polls. And, you know, whether it's Trump or not, I personally and professionally am a believer in government by the, you know, by the people, the consent of the governed. And the only way that happens is at the polls. So I'd rather see high turnout. And then we can at least feel that that's functioning. One of the biggest, as I mentioned in the Bulwark this week in my piece, is one of the biggest impediments to voting is just apathy. But I had a little book party last night for my book, and the new Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jill Karofsky actually came, and she made a little talk. It was unanticipated. It was really terrific. And she said what they were surprised in the Wisconsin midterm, or excuse me, the primary on April 7th, was how many people really, really wanted to vote. That we are going to see, the prediction was we're going to see this groundswell of people really, really wanting to get to the polls and be heard. The problem is time. I mean, mail-in ballots, you have to order them. And that takes third-party vendors. They have to be mailed. You have to apply for them. Then you have to receive them in the mail. Then you have to send them back. The U.S. Postal Service is notoriously slow. They're also running out of money in September, and Trump has vowed to veto any bailout legislation. Then they have to be certified when they get back to the election officials. Right. Those people have to be trained on all of that stuff. And then they have to be counted. So I think, you know, people need to hear now that they should register now to vote by mail, so that at a minimum, it's kind of like having an RSVP for a party. The party holders, that the goers, that is the people in the election offices, know how many people to expect, and to plan for the party, have enough punch. Barring that, I do think there's going to be a decision by a lot of Americans. Do I show up at the polls and risk my health? Or do I stand out this election, even though it disenfranchises me from something that's this important? And that's really a travesty in America, in my view.
It is. And of course, there are so many worst case scenarios here, including this thing being, you know, caught up in the courts for some time, and the questioning of the legitimacy of the vote. But I think we also ought to remind people that Republicans are just as aggressive in pushing absentee balloting as Democrats. This has always been part of the Republican playbook. I mean, Donald Trump himself, a lot of his aides, have voted by mail. So simultaneously, and as part of the Trumpian doublethink, they want to aggressively push voting by mail while also suggesting that voting by mail is a source of massive fraud. So they want to use it, but try to discredit it simultaneously.
Yeah, it seems like message number two is the one that's coming through just when I've kind of done call-in shows in more conservative areas. And as you indicate, I mean, this really helps. This helps, you know, elderly people that are shut-ins and don't want to get sick. I mean, some people in their base, Republican base, rural areas, voting by mail is more convenient for some of Trump's base, I would presume. And also, it tends to increase turnout across the board. It doesn't empirically benefit Democrats over Republicans. And the notion of fraud, of course, five states do it exclusively, including the Republican-leaning Utah. And there's not big concerns of massive voter fraud. I mean, the most comprehensive study was between 4 years, I think 2010 to 2014, a billion ballots were looked at, and only 31 credible cases of voter fraud were identified. So there are mistakes made there. You know, there's definitely bumbling. Most of it is negligence, and that's in part because of the complexity of pulling these things off on a patchwork basis across the country with different levels of funding, different levels of equipment sophistication, different levels of checks and balances and accountability up to the Secretary of State, different levels of volunteers. I mean, most volunteers are also older. We have an all-volunteer army that is out to basically protect the cornerstone of our democracy. It really is something, I think, Charlie, in thinking a lot about this, that Congress needs to revisit, and it needs to be prioritized. I mean, we can do bank transactions, highly private, serious, with serious privacy implications over the internet. I mean, I know we have the technology to figure this out.
I can't even remember the last time I was actually in a bank. That's actually a, that's actually a pretty good analogy. This is also one of those issues where I think that Donald Trump has lost the narrative, that, that he thinks his instincts are to go back and, you know, talk about voter fraud because that's worked with the base in the past. But I don't think that that is playing the way he thinks it does. And, you know, two stories. You mentioned what happened here in Wisconsin and in Georgia, where I think that the backlash to what looked like attempts to suppress the vote was tremendous. That that if people believe that the Republican Party has just decided they do not want lots of people to vote and are going to take steps to suppress the vote, that's going to, they will reap the whirlwind from that. So I, again, you know, I know that Donald Trump thinks that he's got his finger on the pulse of all these culture wars. I think he's misreading that. And I think the story here in Wisconsin of that state Supreme Court election, because I will tell you, nobody saw that result coming. Nobody thought that the liberal candidate, the Democrat bad candidate, was going to win by that kind of a margin, especially considering the fact that they wouldn't postpone the election. So that was a shock, but I think probably an indication of what happens when you play games with this stuff.
Yeah, and the problem that I think Trump is having is COVID-19, the coronavirus, is an equal opportunity infector. It does not care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. And so there are Republican supporters that want to vote. They want to vote for Trump and they don't want to get sick. And that's a, and so if they do it from their home and they put a stamp on it or it's prepaid and they pop it in the mail, they don't put themselves at risk. It's really hard to get around that, I think, as a practical person by person matter. And I know a lot of people now are shrugging off COVID. But in the back of everyone's minds, we still remember the trauma in New York City and the, you know, horrific way these people, 119,000, now 120,000 Americans and counting, have died. Nobody wants to, nobody wants that. And nobody wants to see the infection rate tick up again, even though we're still arguably in the first wave. It hasn't gone, it hasn't settled as in other parts of the world. But I just don't think he can spin his way around science. When I could say science, I mean this little bug that is really miserable and mean.
Well, he thinks he can. And by the way, this is fascinating to me just watching this, that it did feel like about a week ago that America had just like turned the page. That was, you know, season one was COVID and now we've moved on to something else. I mean, you know, wherever I go, nobody's wearing masks. There's no social distancing. And you could just tell that we had gotten tired of it. And so we, you know, our attention spans were short. And then yesterday we got this new model suggesting that 200,000 Americans, the death toll from COVID-19 will be 200,000 by October. So it's very unpredictable. You think that something is gone, will not be a factor, but it could come roaring back. And I think it's that unpredictability that I think both parties need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, well, and it didn't help. You know, of course, the George Floyd riot, protests, riots, First Amendment, peaceful demonstrations that turn violent at the hands of the police, all of that. And those demonstrations are still going on. You know, some epidemiologists and people took the position that, you know, sort of protesting for racial justice somehow outweighs the need to protect the broader public from this vicious, deadly disease. And, the disease doesn't care about politics and racial justice. I mean, the disease is ravaging African Americans in numbers that are intolerable, and that deserves protection as well. So there are a lot of, I think, reasons why we're in this weird state of suspension of reality, because unlike in places like New Zealand and South Korea and places where there was government, real serious intervention in the beginning, contact tracing, massive testing. We haven't had that. We haven't had leadership. So it's still there. It's still circulating in the population. We're learning more about it. Maybe there's some treatments to it. People are more used to the fact that it's sitting around. But this isn't going away anywhere anytime soon, because we just haven't taken the steps in the United States to stomp it out.
No, and just wait for the debates that we have over the Republican convention or the president's rally in Tulsa, where, of course, there's going to be people pushing back on that. And then the right is going to say, but then you had all these Black Lives Matter protests. And the one thing that really worries me is that, if it, this does come roaring back, it, as you pointed out, it hasn't gone away, that there's no way that we're going to shut down, or that we've basically already tribalized the response so that no matter how bad it gets, we are not going to have the kind of leadership. We're not going to see Anthony Fauci standing there at the podium of the White House ever again. We're not going to see the task force. And even Mike Pence, although it seems silly, I mean, that ridiculous piece he wrote for the Wall Street Journal, you know, now sort of playing this down. But that's for another day. Let's focus on the crisis of today. Kim Whaley, congratulations on the new book on voting. The title is, once again,
What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. It's a handbook. It's got 50 state surveys on how to register, how to vote in your particular state. I have updates on COVID on my website, kimwhaley.com, weekly updates on how the changes across the country are happening in particular states. And then the book also kind of has a series of almost op-eds on voting terminology. So it's a quick read. It's accessible. I have wonderful illustrations by this artist. And, you know, if your kids are hanging around at home and you feel like they didn't get the educational experience they should have on Zoom the last few months, that we could, this is something to take into a, to maybe give them, you know, put them on their iPads and make them listen to the book tape. I do think this is civic literacy that is foundational to anyone who wants to participate in their democracy in this country.
And it's an important resource. You're going to want to have this around this fall. You're going to want to have this book around, ask the questions and to be able to answer questions. It's a very important. It is the must-have resource book for 2020. Kim Whaley, thank you so much for joining me on the Bulwark Podcast again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.